Another task to which I was sent was to turn the lathe in the workshop. It was a big, heavy wheel. It needed a good deal of effort to move it, especially when the turner, one of the regimental workmen, was shaping some piece of furniture for the use of an official, such as a banister or a big table leg for which a big log was required. In such cases, it was beyond one man's strength to turn the wheel, and generally two of us were sent, myself and another gentleman, whom I will call B. For several years, whenever anything had to be turned, this task fell to us. B was a frail, weakly young fellow who suffered with his lungs. He had entered the prison a year before my arrival, together with two others, his comrades, one an old man who spent all his time, day and night, saying his prayers, for which he was greatly respected by the convicts, and died before I left prison, and the other quite a young lad, fresh, rosy, strong and full of spirit, who had carried B for more than 500 miles on the journey when the latter was too exhausted to walk. The affection between them was worth seeing. B was a man of very good education, generous feelings, and a lofty character which had been embittered and made irritable by illness. We used to manage the wheel together, and the work interested us both. It was first-rate exercise for me. I was particularly fond, too, of shovelling away the snow. This had to be done, as a rule, after snowstorms, which were pretty frequent in winter. After a snowstorm lasting 24 hours, some houses would be snowed up to the middle of the windows, and others would be almost buried. Then, as soon as the storm was over and the sun came out, we were driven out in big gangs, sometimes the whole lot of us, to shovel away the snowdrifts from the government buildings. Everyone was given a spade. A task was set for all together, and sometimes such a task that it was a wonder they could get through it, and all set to work with a will. The soft new snow, a little frozen at the top, was easily lifted in huge spadefuls, and was scattered about, turning to fine, glistening powder in the air. The spade cut readily into the white mass, sparkling in the sunshine. The convicts were almost always merry over this job. The fresh winter air and the exercise warmed them up. Everyone grew more cheerful. There were sounds of laughter, shouts, jests. They began snowballing each other, not without protest, of course, from the serious ones, who were indignant at the laughter and merriment. And the general excitement usually ended in swearing. Little by little, I began to enlarge my circle of acquaintance, though indeed I did not think of making acquaintances myself. I was still restless, gloomy and mistrustful. My acquaintanceships arose of themselves. One of the first to visit me was a convict called Pietrov. I say, visit me, and I lay special emphasis on the word. Pietrov was in the special division, and lived in the part of the prison farthest from me. There could apparently be no connection between us, and we certainly did and could have nothing in common. And yet in those early days, Pietrov seemed to feel it his duty to come to our room to see me almost every day, or to stop me when I was walking in our leisure hour behind the prison, as much out of sight as I could. At first I disliked this, but he somehow succeeded in making his visits a positive diversion to me, though he was by no means a particularly sociable or talkative man. He was a short, strongly built man, agile and restless, pale with high cheekbones and fearless eyes, with a rather pleasant face, fine, white, close-set teeth, and an everlasting plug of tobacco between them and his lower lip. This habit of holding tobacco in the mouth was common among the convicts. He seemed younger than his age. He was 40 and looked no more than 30. He always talked to me without a trace of constraint, and treated me exactly as his equal, that is, behaved with perfect good breeding and delicacy. If he noticed, for instance, that I was anxious to be alone, he would leave me in 2 or 3 minutes after a few words of conversation, and he always thanked me for attending to him, a courtesy which he never showed, of course, to anyone else in prison. It is curious that such relations continued between us for several years and never became more intimate, though he really was attached to me. I cannot to this day make up my mind what he wanted of me, why he came to me every day. Though he did happen to steal from me later on, he stole, as it were, by accident. He scarcely ever asked me for money, so he did not come for the sake of money, or with any interested motive. I don't know why, but I always felt as though he were not living in prison with me, but somewhere far away, in another house in the town, and that he only visited the prison in passing, to hear the news, to see me, to see how we were all getting on. He was always in a hurry, as though he had left someone waiting for him, or some job unfinished, and yet he did not seem flustered. The look in his eyes, too, was rather strange, intent, with a shade of boldness and mockery. Yet he looked, as it were, into the distance, beyond the things that met his eyes, as though he were trying to make out something else, far away. This gave him an absent-minded look. I sometimes purposely watched where Pietrov went when he left me. Where was someone waiting for him? But he would hurry away from me to a prison ward or a kitchen, would sit down there beside some convicts, listen attentively to their conversation, and sometimes take part in it himself, even speaking animatedly. Then he would suddenly break off and relapse into silence. But whether he were talking or sitting silent, it always appeared that he did so for a moment in passing, that he had something else to do and was expected elsewhere. The strangest thing was that he never had anything to do. He led a life of absolute leisure, except for the regulation work, of course. He knew no sort of trade, and he scarcely ever had any money. But he did not grieve much over the lack of it. And what did he talk to me about? His conversation was as strange as himself. He would see, for instance, that I was walking alone behind the prison, and would turn abruptly in my direction. He always walked quickly, and turned abruptly. He walked up, yet it seemed as if he had been running.
"Good morning."
"Good morning."
I'm not interrupting you."
"No."
"I wanted to ask you about Napoleon. He is a relation of the one who was here in 1812, isn't he?"
Pietrov was a Cantonist and could read and write.
"Yes." "He is some sort of president, they say, isn't he?"
He always asked rapid, abrupt questions, as though he were in a hurry to learn something. It seemed as though he were investigating some matter of great importance which would not allow any delay. I explained how he was a president, and added that he might soon be an emperor.
"How is that?"
I explained that too, as far as I could. Pietrov listened attentively, understanding perfectly, and reflecting rapidly, even turning his ear towards me.
I wanted to ask you, Alexander Pietrovich, is it true, as they say, that there are monkeys with arms down to their heels and as big as a tall man?"
"Yes, there are."
"What are they like?"
That, too, I explained as far as I was able.
"And where do they live?"
"In hot countries. There are some on the island of Sumatra."
"That's in America, isn't it? Don't they say that the people in those parts walk on their heads?"
"Not on their heads. You mean the Antipodes." I explained what America was like, and what was meant by the Antipodes. He listened as attentively as though he had come simply to hear about the Antipodes.
"Ah. Last year I read about the Countess Lavalliere. Arafieff got the book from the adjutants. Is it true, or is it just invented? It's written by Dumas."
"It's invented, of course."
"Well, goodbye. Thank you."
And Pietrov vanished. And we rarely talked except in this style. I began inquiring about him. M. positively warned me when he heard of the acquaintance. He told me that many of the convicts had inspired him with horror, especially at first, in his early days in prison. But not one of them, not even Gazin, had made such a terrible impression on him as this Pietrov.
"He is the most determined, the most fearless of all the convicts," said M. "He is capable of anything. He would stick at nothing if the fancy took him. He would murder you if it happened to strike him. He would murder you in a minute, without flinching or giving it a thought afterwards. I believe he is not quite in his right mind."
This view interested me very much, but M. could give me no reason for thinking in this way, and strange to say, I knew Pietrov for several years afterwards and talked to him almost every day. He was genuinely attached to me all that time, though I am absolutely unable to say why. And all those years he behaved well in prison and did nothing horrible. Yet every time I looked at him, I felt sure that M. was right and that Pietrov really was a most determined and fearless man who recognized no restraint of any sort. Why I felt this, I can't explain either.